Welcome to episode 10 of A Legitimate Salvage, a podcast about The Expanse in which four friends and Doctor Who fans attempt to rewatch seasons 1 through 3 before the season 4 premiere on Amazon in December. Hey, the party is all here for a change. We've got the full Rossinati crew with us. Let's go around and introduce ourselves.
I'm Jen Burt.
I'm Chip Sutterth.
I'm Katie Burt.
And I'm Warren Fry.
And we're going to talk about episodes 9 and 10 of the second season. That's The Weeping Somnambulist and Cascade. But before we do that, we're recording this on October the 10th, which is 1 week away from the New York Comic Con, which was one of the reasons that we were so shorthanded the last time. Katie Burt, you were at New York Comic Con. Can you tell us about all things Expanse that you saw?
I was on the scene at New York Comic Con. Well, first of all, it was really cool just to see giant posters promoting The Expanse, like literally when you first walked in the Javits Center. So that felt different just in terms of how much like money, especially in the space, Amazon was pushing towards marketing the premiere. And then I actually got to see the premiere of season 4, which was so cool.
Tell us all the spoilers, Katie Burt.
Oh, I'll tell you everything that happened. I mean, if I'm sure book readers already have an idea. And actually, the ending of the episode is the clip they showed at San Diego Comic-Con, which I was also able to go to the panel for that. So that was interesting seeing that in context. But in general, the episode just felt, especially after having rewatched so many of these episodes that feel so fast and so plot-driven, maybe it's because I was watching it for the first time, unlike all of these episodes that I'm watching at least for the second time, but it felt like the characters were able to catch their breaths and like reset in a way that was really nice. I also got to talk to a few of the executive producers and a few of the cast members, including Bern Gorman, who's going to be playing a new character in season 4. So that was really cool, both as an Expanse fan and as a Torchwood fan, because he was on the show Torchwood, which someone asked him about during the Expanse panel, and he quickly was like, yeah, we're here for the Expanse, in a very charming British way. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. And Jen actually got to do the activation, the Expanse activation that was there
Expanse
as well.
Expanse activation?
Yes,
please explain.
It was basically... Yes, so it was one of these things where, you know, you stand in line and they had some props and costumes there. Like, they had the outfit that Christian wears in the snow when she goes to visit Holden's family, which was cool. And then they had some of the space suits. But then the coolest part was you got to go in and they had an actual chair from the Rossinati that you could sit in and pretend you were... They had some screens up to pretend
you
were
flying. Did they have the drug that goes in your neck or not?
No. But I have to say, the thing I noticed was the chair is very comfortable. I was like, I feel glad that this is comfortable.
They sit in them for an awful lot.
Yeah, exactly. So it was like, very comfortable. That was cool.
I'm not sure how much I'm supposed to say about the premiere episode, even though, again, there were lots of people in the room with me. But it's funny that you mention, did you mention Holden's family?
Yeah.
Because they're in the premiere episode, which was kind of a cool thing to watch after so quickly after having, you know, rewatched earlier episodes and having talked about, you know, we haven't seen his mom in a while or we haven't seen this context. So there's a little teaser for the season 4 premiere.
Sounds awesome, and I wish that I was inside your head so that I could see what you saw.
I get to see a lot of cool stuff.
People with fun jobs. Well, let's move from that to the episode that we actually watched, and... let's do the quick, clever episode synopses and then get the hot takes and talk about those episodes as we watched them and as if we had never seen any of the episodes to follow that. Anyway, episode 1 today is The Weeping Somnambulist, and that was first aired on March 22nd, 2017. Meet the crew of the most annoyingly named freighter in history next to the Kobayashi Maru. The Rossi crew pretty much hijack the Weeping Somnambulist as it brings relief supplies to Ganymede. But when the local cops threaten to kill the crew and take their stuff, James and Amos intervene and rescue, well, half of the crew? They commence their search for Prax's daughter, feeling pretty bad about their planning abilities and the collateral damage they've inflicted so far. Meanwhile, Gunnery Sergeant Draper and the Mars delegation land on unfriendly and heavy Earth soil. As ordered, Bobby lies and says that the incident was her fault. But on cross-examination by Avasarala, she breaks and mentions the attacker without a vac suit. The same day, Avasarala gets a report from her mole on the Arbogast research ship. There's life, or something, happening at the impact crater on Venus. Put a vac suitless humanoid and life on Venus together, and you get a Christian Avasarala with the heebie-jeebies. And I think I pronounced her last name about three different times in that recap.
Well, the next episode we watched was Cascade, which aired on March 29th, 2017. Avasarala leans into the heebie-jeebies. She thinks Draper was telling the truth. And surprise, surprise, Aaron Wright looks nervous as he's expecting proto-molecule to be found in Draper's armor. In the end, he shows up in Avasarala's office and spills everything. His relationship with Jewel Pierre Mao, his belief that Mars was testing proto-molecule weaponry on Ganymede, everything. Avasarala keeps the news to herself, and when she finds out Draper's gone AWOL from the Martian embassy to see the ocean, she spills everything to Draper just before she's retrieved, and Draper's not prepared to believe that her own government used her Marines as guinea pigs. Meanwhile, the search on Ganymede continues with Amos, who is not a homicidal maniac. He said so, beating the chicken out of a hacker guy known for finding things on the surveillance network. Thus convinced, the guy tracks May and the mysterious Dr. Strickland to an old camera-free section of the station. At the same time, Prax discovers that the delicate station ecosystem has fallen past the point of no return, with no one knowing or acknowledging it. Concurrently, Alex is in orbit and discovers that Mars has ordered a no-fly zone around Ganymede. The Rossi crew is stuck. Forever. End of series. Season 3 and 4 are a myth.
And that was The Weeping Somnambulist and Cascade and first gut impressions of these episodes.
I gotta say, I disagree with you on the name thing. I like Kobayashi Maru and The Weeping Somnambulist.
I like Kobayashi Maru. This one's hard for me. I was just impressed that Chip, like, voluntarily said it so many times in that synopsis.
It's a tongue twister. I like trying. I mean, I don't know.
It needs a nickname like the Rossi. Like, the Rosinante isn't even hard to say, and it has
Weepy.
A nickname.
There you go.
The Weepy or the Sleepy.
Or Sami.
Oh.
I mean, Somnambulist.
The Sleepy's not Sleepy.
So let's talk about, let's talk about, you know, I have said many times on this show that I am a Babylon 5 fan, and that's like classic 90s sci-fi. And I kind of felt like I was watching 90s sci-fi all over again, especially with The Weeping Somnambulist. I feel for the plight of the characters who fly that freighter, but I can't say that I was super impressed with either the dialogue or the acting chops of the Riversong clone who was steering the ship. It just and the whole a lot of these two episodes felt a little padded and talky and if not preachy, just kind of stagey. I don't know. Convince me I'm wrong, guys.
I watched them on a plane, so pretty much anything you throw at me, I'll take. Like my plane tolerance for entertainment is pretty low. So you're not wrong. I just didn't mind.
I would say, I mean, I do think some of the dialogue with her, Melissa, the kind of leader of
the River Song.
I do think some of the dialogue she has about, like, oh, I'm just going to save a couple people with my, like, refugee supplies is a little bit much as a, like, plot kind of contrast to Holden's quest to save everything. But I really liked that actress. And I think, like, showing kind of I don't, she's almost instantly has to mourn her dead partner. And I don't know. I bought it, I think, as not being too melodramatic. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Jen and I have similar narrative sensibilities. But I felt the same way. I think the fact that we do get to see her in a few scenes, and I think it might, for me, just be the actress, maybe the fact that she reminds me of River Song. And also, the fact that when we first meet her, we don't know that that's the Rossi crew. I mean, you may be able to figure it out, but for me at least, I'm immediately like on her side, I guess, because it feel, you know, she's being like shaken down by these seemingly like authoritarian forces in a way that also reminds me actually of Diogo and his uncle, my favorite character, Diogo.
Everybody's favorite character.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think the way that she's introduced where like is in terms where we're predisposed to like her, and the fact that she's kind of allowed to be, we don't often see the Rossi like using people that actively for that long. In that way. So for me it worked. Jen and I were discussing how a character like Katoa's dad, who's only in one scene, and at least for me, like acting wise, it's a tall order, but was not really able to sell what he's been given, was less effective and felt much more like plot driven. Didn't introduce a lot of like interesting thematic questions in the way that the Melissa character did. Especially on this question of collateral damage that you brought up in the synopsis.
What about, along those lines, what about Roma, everybody's least favorite hacker and chicken eater?
He is not memorable to me at all.
No, I forgot he existed.
I mean, yeah, until I think now. He's like, yeah, he's memorable in the way the characters we already kind of know interact with him, mm-hmm. but I think he is just like totally...
Yeah, I just feel like I like these episodes. I mean, and the quality of The Expanse from episode to episode, series long, is pretty damn consistent. So mm-hmm. I feel like I'm sort of splitting hairs or whatever. But I just felt like there was a little bit of something missing from these two, and I can't quite put my finger on it. Something about the execution.
I think for me, the stuff that's happening on Earth is so riveting that it carries the rest of the episodes for me. Not that they, at least the stuff on the on Ganymede, it's not bad to me. I think the stuff on the Arbogast I'm less invested in and feels even like more clunky because I don't actually have as much context, or like there has been very little character work done in that setting, in that storyline. But yeah, the Earth stuff is just so gripping to me that even though we're kind of treading water or building suspense to a certain extent on Ganymede, it works, especially because we're seeing these characters tested in new, like, moral ways, which is always interesting with the Rossi crew.
Plus, you're getting the Earth and Mars kind of contingents coming together. That's just inherently more interesting than, oh, more space station
stuff.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean... One last thought on this thread that we've been talking about is that I guess the first rule of The Expanse really is if you're introduced to some minor characters and they show affection to each other, one of them's not going to make it out at the end of the episode.
And we can talk a little bit more about this in the spoilery section, but I think... there's something that happens in relation to... the freighter later that makes me more invested in that storyline, perhaps.
Perhaps. This is true. Yeah. Not that we have any idea what's going to happen. No. Other stuff, other thoughts about how the episode was written and directed?
Well, you wrote down here Mikhail Solomon directed it, and I'd forgotten that name, but he was quite the big deal back in the day as a cinematographer. So I was surprised to find that his TV career, as I went over IMDb, is much more prolific, or maybe not much more, but as prolific as cinematographer ever was. So, but yeah, I couldn't have he didn't have any distinctive style that I could tell. Although I have to say, we also have written down how there's a whole padded, and it definitely is padding, area where Alex is floating around and drinking beer that's in weightless form. And it's all kind of pointless, but it is also damn cool looking.
How the hell did they do that?
I don't know. I will say, too, people should look up Michaela Solomon's IMDb, because it was really interesting to me to read all of the things he had worked on.
Yeah, like he worked on The Abyss and like I think Always, the Spielberg movie, and then he just kind of did this weird right turn into TV way before anybody else did.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't like he was part of the filmmakers moving into the world of TV as TV was becoming more prestige. It was like
Which earlier almost makes than me think that, maybe he really wanted to direct badly and he's like, "Okay, fine, I'll do TV when it's not prestigious." Mm-hmm. Or who knows, maybe he said the wrong thing to the wrong guy, which is known to happen in Hollywood, and he said, okay, you're doing TV from now on. And he just kind of lucked into it being the thing now.
I will say, too, that these episodes include some really cool, I mean, I don't necessarily know how they did them, but, like, locations in the sense that are, you don't really see again, and you see only in these episodes. I'm thinking specifically about where they have the meeting for the Earth Summit. Mars Peace Summit, which I think did a lot of work. And also just seeing Christian like move through those like much larger spaces. It really set the scene for those, and like just how massive those rooms are and how little space they take up. Seeing Bobby just like look small in a way that she normally doesn't, because she's not a small person, was really effective. And also all the stuff with her, you know, looking out on the water in that long tunnel.
I don't sorry.
Yeah, no, continue.
The geography of where she's at didn't make any sense to me, because she's supposedly over by where the UN is, right? That's where that general area is. And I'm like, that's way too dense for them to have these big, like, LA-style water tunnel type areas. And then just this, you know, just this big water area that isn't covered in stuff. Because it already is in the 21st century, so... If that's supposed to be New York. Unless the water rise
that's a good point.
Who knows? It just didn't ring through to me.
There has to be a lot of hand-wavy things, I guess, about how the geography has changed due to climate change.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's just me being nitpicky about New York geography, which is stupid on my part, but oh well.
No, that's a good point. And it's also things that, like I said before, it is cool to see new places, but there isn't really a logic established in a way that there would be potentially if they were settings that we'd see again and again.
Yeah.
The episodes were written by Hallie Lambert. She's actually pretty prolific with The Expanse. She's been a staff writer and story editor with a lot of this stuff. And you know, I had some qualms about the soliloquizing, but it's still, you know, it's well written. And especially with Cascade, the sense of dread that I have as that episode goes on and Prax reveals that, you know, when somebody there in one of the domes says, "We're going to rebuild," and Prax finds out pretty quickly, no, you're not. There's a lot of dread that rises for me in these episodes over time.
Yeah, I think you're right, and that Cascade is a stronger episode as well.
So say we all?
Yeah, it's probably true. So yes, we say all.
let's talk a little bit about Bobby for a minute. You know, geography aside, this is a powerful. We're seeing a powerful chunk of character arc here, and I feel for her every moment.
Ugh, I love Bobby's stuff so much in these episodes. Just like the repetition of her just wanting to see the ocean. She's been through so much, and, you know, Jen and Chip discussed this in the last week's episode of her also, like, going through a trauma and then having to be re-traumatized by this process, which, you know, here we see before the Martians didn't, you know, necessarily care about how emotionally distressing it was for Bobby to have to relive that. But now they use it as an excuse to keep her from saying more to the Earthers. But really beautiful work done by Frankie Adams. And I'm just constantly amazed by how much she can do, even in a scene with little to no dialogue.
True.
She has an encounter with you know, sort of a drug dealer, sort of a street doctor guy named Nico, and it's kind of tropey, but it's still kind of beautiful in a way. He's apparently seen Martians sneak away from the embassy before. That ocean is apparently a powerful lure, and when he gives Bobby tips on how to walk like an Earther, you know, the tilt your, stand up straight, tilt your chin up millimeter by millimeter by millimeter until you get to the horizon. I thought that that was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love just how much we're learning about Earth, because we as viewers don't really know that much about what Earth culture is like at this point either. And the fact that we're aligned with Bobby's point of view, where she also has, you know, she has all this propaganda or what she's heard, and knowing, you know, everything she learns is just like complexifying and or debunking, you know, what she's heard. I mean, there's some things that are true, but as all truths are, it's more complex than she thought. In terms of the Nico character, I love that scene so much. I wonder if it was a directorial decision or if it was written in the script to have him kind of like disappear at the end. Because I did find that very strange. Like, I wasn't sure what they wanted us to pull from that as viewers.
Yeah.
What, one other thing, than that. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Warren.
I was going to say one thing about her whole I need to see the ocean thing. It kind of struck me as... I see, I understand why, but I also, she's so straight and narrow when it comes to the military that I kind of almost didn't buy that she would take off and abandon her post because of, she wants to see the ocean. It seemed almost too frivolous for her for a thing to do, even though she's just been screwed over by these guys. You know what I mean?
So there's a part in the scene where her, I guess, commanding officer comes in right before she breaks out and says, well, you know, we're sending you back to Mars, you're not gonna get, and she asks about whether she gets, why can't I see the ocean, and he's like, it's too bureaucratic, we can't do it. But there was something in what he said that I kind of understood to mean that she was maybe going to be discharged when she got sent back,
that they were going to do the right thing for her and the MCRN. yeah
and so I wonder how much that influences her decision of like, this has been so much of her identity that she is being, well, I guess if I'm gonna get totally, she's already been screwed over by having to tell this lie, but then also to have to be like, well, and everything you have done for yourself and because you believe in this cause, it's kind of getting thrown out the window too. I think that's why I
buy
it.
That, and there's also, you know, she's up until this point anyway, she's just all in for Mars's military character, you know, she's all in for for taking it to the Earthers, but she also resents that that's necessary, because when we first saw her, she was looking at an area of Mars that if they hadn't had to militarize, you know, maybe they'd be a lot farther away towards terraforming. She wants to see oceans on Mars, and you know, and she dreams of that for them. So she wants to see for herself what Mars is going to look like in a couple hundred years. Maybe.
I get the feeling the don't they actually say the Martian lifespan is something like 120 years?
Yeah, I think
a
so.
A few episodes back, they list off how they live longer than Earthlings, even though they shouldn't. Due to the gravity and everything else.
Yeah, they're just stubborn. And and that brings me actually to some of the world building about Earth. Universal basic income is a thing, and the hardscrabble Martians aren't a fan of it. They look down on Earth as soft and wasteful. You know, it's like Spartans versus Athenians. But But when we get when she's going through the I don't know what you'd call it, the
it's like the a tent city. City.
Yeah, when she's going through the tent city, that gives us a completely different look at Earth than we've had before, and I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, I've actually been reading a book about universal basic income, and this is definitely, to my eyes, not a very positive representation of what that might look like. I mean, it's also a very, you know, we see a very specific place that could not be, might not be representative of, you know, everything right. else, but it feels much more like, I don't know, like a reflection of some of our current problems than, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to, I think not knowing more about Earth is, well, on this rewatch has been hard for me. I'd like mm-hmm. to understand more about that massive part of this, you know, story in this world. It's ironic that that's the one we know least about.
Yeah. What do we know about yeah. Earth? We've got, there's this huge UN bureaucracy. We know about that. We know that there are a few hippies out there that Holden has 42 parents. We know that there are tent cities and universal basic income.
We know Baltimore still exists.
And, yeah. is a rough place.
still.
Yeah.
But I like how they're trading off propaganda. It's like, I don't believe this part about you, and you don't believe this part about me, even though this is what we've been told about each other. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the details I love about, I just love Christian and Bobby's, all of their interactions. But when Christian is asking her questions, she demonstrates some of the like small things she knows about how Martians see Earth. The fact that she says, you know, you know it as like we're takers or they're takers. Yeah, I wanted more insight into that too, like how much Christian knows about Martian culture, because obviously it's in her best interest to know a certain extent, at least in how they view Earth. But yeah, so much of what we learn about Earth is through the perspective that's like, you know, 2 degrees removed. It's Bobby's perspective as seen through Christian. So there's so many lenses that are separating us from what this place might actually be like.
The negotiating table. Earth and Mars in a room together. I haven't seen a lot of negotiation scenes where, well, I haven't seen a whole lot of negotiation scenes in pop culture generally, but going
since TNG,
yeah,
basically,
yeah, and everybody in TNG, you know, if the TNG folks are involved, everybody's reasonable. If they're watching two alien races, then the alien races are at each other's throats or whatever. But in this one, the disdain Mars and Earth have for each other, and they're just doggedly getting a deal done anyway, is fascinating to watch. And it's fascinating to watch Aaron Wright and Avassarlah, who are not exactly on the same team right now, still playing their roles and really throwing some elbows and kind of appreciating it when the one throws the elbows and, you know, at the Mars, the other one's like, yeah, that's well played.
Oh, I mean, you can tell from those negotiations how long they've worked together and probably been in. I mean, this is obviously unique in the fact that they're finally having this Martian Earth Peace Summit, but like they've been at a table similar to this probably for thousands of hours. And that I think really comes through.
For sure. For sure. And what is when one of the Martians asks Christian where she's going with this line of this questioning, and she responds wherever the F I G D well, like, you know.
Oh, she just delivers that line so well in an unexpected
way. She's just so
good
at swearing.
Oh, yeah. It's a real amazing skill.
Okay, another tidbit from the season 4 premiere. There's even more swearing.
Oh, sweet.
As you might expect from not being on basic cable.
Oh, for sure, yeah. For sure. Anything else from that scene before we get to maybe Christian and Aaron Wright?
I like that the Martians are just as good at this as they are. That they're not going to get pushed around at all.
Even though they've got the weaker hand.
Yeah.
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 But Aaron Wright, man, he breaks down. He gives up. He tells Christian everything, which is really helpful for those of us who have short attention spans and have to be reminded of the intricacies of the plot from now on. No.
Yep.
But I did not see that coming. The first time I watched it, anyway. I didn't see it coming this time,
to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of this until we were reading the synopses at the beginning of this episode. But for two characters, you know, Christian and Aaron Wright, who are so good at keeping secrets and doling out information in small parcels when they see fit, these episodes see both of them, you know, Christian with Bobby and then Aaron Wright with Christian, just kind of laying a lot of information all at once on, you know, onto the table in a way that is not normal for them.
Leading up to this, we've seen the pressure on Aaron Wright when Eros was heading their way. You know, he's screaming at Jewel Pierre Mao in communication along the way. When they're going over Bobby's armor and he's like, check it again, you know, the sense you have is the pressure's going up, and then when he starts spilling to Avacerilla, you sort of realize that he recognized that the jig is up. He's going to get found out anyway.
Yeah, this definitely doesn't seem like his first choice.
No.
No.
And I do like how, you know, you mentioned Aaron Wright kind of laying out some of the plot helpfully for us. But I also think it's important seeing how angry Christian is and her laying out the stakes back to him, which I think works maybe a little bit better in terms of her character in this moment. But then also I always call him her spy guy. Her spy guy.
Kotjar.
Also kind of questioning. You know, as Jen mentioned, these two have obviously worked together a long time. Wondering if maybe not telling anyone else is a mistake. And it's interesting to have someone be even in the position to challenge Christian in that way, because she's so rarely has anyone who is both on her side and has the same information.
For sure. And he leaves that scene with just a spring in his step. It's happy Kotjar. And he's like, feels good to be on the side of the good guys for a change. And he's genuinely enjoying that.
He just looks like he knows more than he's letting on.
Oh, well, yeah.
That's a good quality for a spy to have.
True, I suppose. Yes. No, but you just got that kind of nudge and a wink thing going on.
Yeah,
I love when he comes in and like tells her, like my inside people at the Martian embassy, like here's what's up. He really revels in like revealing all of the things he's found out too. I like that actor a lot.
Yeah, he's in a terrible storyline in Star Trek Discovery Season 2.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, if right. If you'd like to check that guy out.
Well,
I'm glad you agree with me on that. I was very confused by most of the end of Star Trek Discovery Season 2.
Yeah. We could go.
Haven't seen it.
It just is it's a good exercise in seeing what an actor can do with different, you know, levels of material.
Before we dip into the spoiler zone, I think we need to go back to Ganymede real quick and the progression that Holden is making, and Holden has reached the point where he is now killing multiple people at a time, going in after the cops, guns blazing. It's not like the shootout in total self-defense. You know, he had a plan there. And the line that Naomi says, because they're both dealing with some regrets or trepidation about what they've been through. You know, every shitty thing we do makes the next thing that much easier, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't Holden the righteous one there for a while?
No, not anymore.
No.
I feel like he was definitely the one who was good at giving righteous speeches. But, you know, also the righteous one. I was thinking a lot in these episodes about how much, I don't know, just the phrase, like, the ends justify the means, and how true that is for different characters. And Naomi is someone who seems to be able to hold on to that idea that, I mean, she's also held back from really taking action in these scenes, but sometimes literally, but is able to say that, no, you know, sometimes the means are too much or too harsh or too cruel or too much. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also, you have, you know, Amos and Holden kind of roll in almost like action heroes here, in that, like, they're trying to, like, save the day and don't think about this potential collateral damage. But then you still have Amos saying, like, Naomi and Holden, those are the kind of people you want to find your daughter. Like, even as Holden is kind of edging into, I mean, he's light years away from Amos still, for sure. He still has a way of justifying this morality. But definitely way more willing to kill people now.
Definitely. Well, it's the protomolecule. He's after, you know, he is still on a quest to eliminate the protomolecule wherever it shows up in the system, and he's just really, really darn single-minded about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, did I just make this up in my head, or does Amos at some point, this might be a little spoiler, say he actually has empathy removed because he ended up talking to that scientist guy who had the same thing happen? Did he have that same thing happen to him, or is he just weird? I don't remember.
He's just weird.
Okay. Yeah.
So for some reason, I concocted it in my head that he had gone through the same procedure.
No, he's not, because he's not a homicidal maniac.
Well, of course.
Do you know how many people you've killed? No. What?
It's a very doctor-y question, too.
It is. Oh, my God. Yeah. Okay, 14th Doctor, Wes Chatham. That would be interesting.
I do think it's like, I still think that Amos is in a lot of ways a good judge of character. It's just when he decides someone needs to be punished, the degree to which he'll punish them, I think, is the scary thing. Because I think the fact that he pegs this guy as someone who uses his power, the chicken guy, who uses his power to manipulate, exploit, hurt vulnerable people, you know, that's true. But then the fact that he starts, you know, beating him over the head with said chicken is perhaps an overreaction.
I think I read Amos as someone who still has empathy. And I think there is something in that scene where he's talking to the guy who's totally had his empathy removed, when he does, the guy's like, you could have it totally removed. Like, I read Amos as someone who has gone through these deeply traumatic things from a young age and developed these survival mechanisms that make his empathy just very not present from how he makes decisions, and has terrible understanding of how to react. His instant reaction is violence. In so many, as opposed to being like, well, I should maybe think about this a little bit.
Yeah. But they're it's a rational instinct for potentially how he grew up.
Yeah.
Or well, the belt doesn't really reward thinking about things, though, doesn't it? Like, no. Generally speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he does have that line when they get to Ganymede that it reminds him of Baltimore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting context to think about what follows in terms of how he acts while he's there.
For sure, for sure. But hopefully Baltimore is not on the verge of, like, dying outright, which is what Prax discovers as he goes through the plants. You know, he finally has, he's finally in his element and can do some stuff. And I'm feeling some kind of a way, some kind of foreboding about what's going to happen on Ganymede, but this is pretty awful.
Yeah, for also, obviously he's a complex character who has, you know, levels of things he cares about, but also for him to be distracted from his mission to find his daughter, like, you know, things have to be bad, as they visibly are. Yeah, but it's cool that his, like, superpower is plant knowledge. I'm also, though, like, does no one else know about the plants? It seems like there would be a lot of farmer types on this station.
And just, it's a keystone to survival here, let alone in space. So you'd think it'd be kind of top of mind.
Yeah.
And I do love that he's looking at these plants like, oh, they're discolored. They're clearly not doing well. When, like, the way the set design is you're like, I am a farmer, so I know that, yes, this looks terrible, but I don't think you have to know much to be like, that plant wall that looks like it was in our mall is dead.
Yeah. Like, we all eat vegetables.
Like, there's a level where you're all like, I think anyone could look at a lot of these plants and be like, well, they're beyond help.
Oh, I think the last place we need to stop by before we check out the spoilers is the skies of Venus and the Arbogast.
Oh, yeah.
And
what a cranky ship that is.
The skies of Venus just makes it sound like a vacation destination. Like, you'd send a postcard back.
When it's anything but.
So I really despise this scientist guy. He's funny, but he's such a jerk.
Yeah, which one are you talking about? They're both jerks.
They're both kind of
I don't know. I mean, Colonel Janice, is it just me, or does he have Barack Obama's DNA in there somewhere? Think about it.
He's done with the nonsense. That's
he's done with the nonsense, and he's just sort of, you know, mildly Vulcan. Take a good look at him if he shows up in any future episodes. Take a good look at him. You know, I think he's a distant ancestor of Barack Obama.
He looks like he's been in Star Trek for sure. He just looks like that kind of an actor.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't actually know how I feel about him because I had such a strong feeling about who's Christian's dude. What's his name?
Australian guy, yeah. I can't remember.
Let's just call him Australian guy and be done with it.
Australian guy. You know, he is obviously supposed to be the one we think is, like, cool and cavalier. And why is this other guy, like, why does he hate science so much?
That guy flirts with
kind of have a point, like, though.
Yeah, I think now that you're, like, I knew that the Australian guy annoyed me, but I don't think I gave as much thought into, like, how I feel about the straight man in the situation. The buzzkill of the situation, which is how he's contextualized.
Yeah, for me, he's like, you're in this tiny, probably tiny ship where there's not that much room for maneuvering, and he's swaggering around. You're like, yeah, I don't need to deal with this for 6 months or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I don't blame the guy for being annoyed with him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's introduced as, like, someone Christian likes. So I think that gives him some leeway to begin with, but that quickly runs out. And it hurts that we don't spend more time with him. He comes off as very one note. You know, thus far we don't know him that well. He's always just kind of joking, it seems like. He doesn't take things seriously when I'm just like, everything is serious.
Yeah, I think too, it's like he's like giving his pitch for like, but there could be so much intelligent life out there. But instead of it coming across as like, isn't this amazing? It comes across like he's trying to, like, give the
pedantic
other scientist a hard time.
Yeah, yeah. Also, I like how he shows Drake's equation, which is an actual real thing, and then goes, and then the other guy goes, that's kid stuff. Who cares?
Yeah, like, I feel like one of the things that's great about a scientist character, or a character who is an outlier on a expedition later in the series, is that they want to teach and meet people where they're at. I'm being very vague right now because we're in the spoiler-free section. This is not even a big spoiler. But just in general, like, I think like the best scientists are, or I guess the best people are people who are able to meet people where they're at and, like, teach and communicate. And that seems like it would be in his best interest. But you're right. He just is kind of holding his intelligence and his education over this other guy instead of trying to explain anything to him.
Mm-hmm. Which is always annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shall we voyage down to the surface of Venus, which I'm reliably told is the spoiler zone for the rest of the series?
Sounds dangerous. Sure.
Chip, your segues are so good, though. I'll follow you anywhere.
Well, yeah. For those...
Let's all burn together.
So for those of you who haven't watched past episode 10 of season 2 and are trying to have sort of that primal, original Expanse experience, and you don't want to be spoiled, it's time to hide in a crater on one of Jupiter's moons. We hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of season 2's Here There Be Dragons and The Monster and the Rocket. So you can subscribe to Legitimate Salvage wherever good podcasts are found and follow us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. So thanks for joining us. And those of you who are well-versed in the Expanse, let's dive in. And we're back. And I think we could spend like an hour alone on freaking Sadavir Aaron Wright, who I think I actually hate more than Diogo.
I hate Diogo more. Diogo's much more irritating. You could actually sit down and talk to Aaron Wright. You wouldn't like him, but it'd be civilized. Diogo, you'd just be like, I just want to deck you within seconds.
Well, here's the thing, friends. Aaron Wright played me. I bought his stuff hook, line, and sinker the first time around, and when he turns on Avasarala and blackmails Gilles Pierre Mao and sets them all up to die, I am like, you bastard.
He's so good. He's so good at being bad.
How did his turn in this episode when he gives everything up to Christian? Did you buy it then? And do you kick yourself like I did for buying it now?
Yes, I think I was kind of I still get suckered. He's very good at suckering you in, so. So yes, I would agree with you on that. Doesn't burn me quite as much, but yeah.
Yeah. He's that actor really sells it.
Yeah, exactly.
I know where it's going. I'm just like, he does seem really, I really believe him when he says he didn't know how bad Eris was going to be, you know? He really just seems truly contrite.
I really thought that in a couple of episodes, you know, he's going to be he's going to sound like he's getting ready to make his peace with his son before he kills himself or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Exactly what I thought.
I thought that
was
going to happen.
The son with the scene with his son is so well done because you watch it the first time and that's exactly what you think. You think he's getting ready to turn himself in. And you watch it the second time and it works just as well, knowing the truth, which is that he's doubling down on his villainy.
Oh, yeah, because when she says, like, you're going to have to pay for this, basically, and he's like, I know. And you're like, yeah. I totally buy it.
I think it works really well.
But also, how can you trust a man called Sadavir, really? I mean, come on.
It's a good point. I think it works so well, too, because Christian seems to trust him. Mm-hmm. And we've been conditioned to...
She's so smart.
Yeah, to value that about her. She has a very good sense of who's lying and who's not. And I did, watching it the second time, he almost fooled me again. I mean, obviously he didn't because I know what's going to happen. But it didn't make me mad so much as I was curious, like, how far ahead he plans. He seems like his very flexible dude who's, because like I said, this didn't seem like his first choice to tell Christian all of these things. He's kind of been waiting to see how things are going to fall. And I think he has lots of contingency plans. So I'm curious at this point, maybe he, I don't believe that he is ready to take accountability, but I don't know if he's already knows that he is going to scapegoat Christian.
He seems like the kind of guy who is like, all right, these are the ways I could take accountability and how it would play out for me. Like, not his first choice, probably not his fifth choice, but if he had to, like, yeah.
Yeah.
He has, like, okay, what do I own up to? What does she have me on? But also, you have Kotiar being like, this puts you in a precarious situation that you're not turning him in. And he's totally right, because Erin Wray tries to get her killed. Man.
Yeah. He's one of the top science fiction villains in the whole canon, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm excited to see the rest of his storyline play out again.
Yeah, I mean, he's in the end, he's just purely unrepentant, which is what makes this fake repentance just really, really, really great on me. And how far would he have taken it if he hadn't had the opportunity to double-cross Christian? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. We will never know.
No.
But also, he's doing it kind of for Earth, sort of, kind of, a little bit. So he's not just a cackling... mustache twirling jerk.
No, but he definitely feels he's definitely motivated to try to make Earth great again, and that's just no.
Yeah, I'm not saying I like the guy, but
I know
the
part,
best villains are a little multi-dimensional, and he kind of is. So,
well, the part where he tells Christian, "You're the one who taught me to put Earth first," mm-hmm. which feels so like manipulative, and she just pushes back against that immediately. But it just makes me wonder what every single thing he says, how much does he really believe it? And that's cool to be able to do that with a character. They did such a good job like crafting his character.
But you're all talking about this makes me look at early Christian, like early in season one, in a new light. Because she was, in a way they were each other's proteges, I think, at some points. But, if she taught him to put Earth first, and you see her, torturing a belter, you see her doing all this kinds of stuff early on before she recognizes that the problems that they're facing are bigger. And Earth First isn't going to be an adequate solution to protecting the Earth. It makes me understand. I think we thought that she was kind of off early on because we knew her so well over time. And now I feel a little differently about that.
Like maybe she's changed?
Like she genuinely evolved over time, but that in the beginning she was... much like Sadavir is now.
That's true.
Well, you also have the Frank character early on who talks about, like, even her as a child being pretty kind of Machiavellian in some ways, or just pretty having always had this streak of, like, kind of the darker side of politics, even as a kid. So, yeah, I wonder how he sees her is interesting. Like you're saying, how does she change?
And also how his death affects her and changes her, because she brings him up in these episodes. And so she obviously, of course, is still thinking of him. She brings him up to Bobby. And it's obviously, you know, a good bit of diplomacy in the sense that she's like, oh, I have a friend who loved Mars. But also, I think the fact that he loved Mars and that she did love and respect him and that he was killed as a part of this ever-growing thing made her question things and maybe reassess and change her value structure in the way that you're talking about, Chip.
But also, I think you have Erin Wright betraying her in some ways by getting her friend killed, and it's coupled with him just like being okay with mass murder. Mm-hmm. There's like the very small individual things that he does to her, and the just
the things he does to everyone.
Yeah,
which are reprehensible, frankly.
The crimes against humanity versus the crimes against individual humans.
What is his exact position? Because he's not in charge, because there's that guy above him, and he's not the military guy in charge, but what is he?
That is a good question.
I thought he was, like, the second in command.
Yeah, I thought so, too, but that would make... But I also think Christian is, too, so I don't know.
She's
sure.
Second. He's the number two to the Secretary General, and Christian right. is the okay, undersecretary yeah. for him.
Okay.
I'm not really sure what that means, because there is that line early on where he is talking about, and maybe her position changes, but how she's like, you know, so important, but isn't accountable to anyone.
Well, I think too, it's like, is she someone who was in the military and became kind of a career civil servant politician, where he's a politician, right? Like he's elected maybe,
and she's appointed.
Yeah.
So she is at this point in the story, she is the deputy undersecretary. Sadavir is the undersecretary, and then Esteban Sorrento Gillis is the feckless, annoying, swamp dwelling secretary general.
You tell him.
Yeah.
The more I get to know him, the less I like him. You know, he seems like just sort of bland Mitt Romney kind of presidential figure. And then as they're talking about how the negotiations are going and how far they should go, and he says, squeeze the dusters for everything they're worth or whatever like that. He's just... And then...
Well, Chip, you've just summed up being a Canadian for the last 4 years, so okay.
and then he just keeps getting worse when his ex slash spiritual guide or whatever the Methodist preacher Anna Volodarov, I forget her last name, I'm awful at this, sorry listeners, you know, he's just vacant, he's an empty suit. I don't like him either. I don't like him. Yeah. I don't like Sadavir. I don't like Diogo.
Well, the thing about him, too, is I don't like him, and he doesn't seem to be very good at his job, which shouldn't be the ultimate crime compared to, like, all of the other crimes, like, legitimate crimes that are being committed. But, yeah, he is just bland. He ends up being a good character, I think, in the sense that he is representative of what feels like a lot of real world politicians. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they haven't changed in 200 years. They're still manipulative bums.
Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, any other stuff that we want to talk about in the spoiler world? Oh, Bobby.
Yeah.
I mean, this is her big turnaround, right? So Kinda. There's later on when she actually just speaks against Mars. So I guess that would be the top of her arc. But this is where it starts, I guess.
For sure, for sure. I mean, she's about to declare asylum, and that just feels like that. At the time when she does that, that feels like that's just going to break her, because she's turning her back on Mars, and she loves Mars more than she ever will love Earth. I think these two episodes, as far as her arc is concerned, are perfectly constructed. They take just the right amount of time to set up where she's going.
I love this arc with Bobby so much. I can't wait to see the rest of it. Like, I love when she, asks for asylum, all the stuff that happens with Christian. Yeah, I can't wait.
She really, Frankie Adams just sells it in a, I think rewatching this, seeing how one note she is early, not, or just.
Well, she's military, right? So it's kind of baked in.
Yeah, to see that she goes from that to here, you really see her deciding to change sides and to see, be open enough to see what the other side is, and that there's more than just a few sides. Like with Christian being like, they're kind of making this pitch for like, this is more than Earth or Mars, and her being willing to accept that being told to her and to think about the world in a different way.
Yeah, to give up a simple worldview for a more complex one is really difficult and scary.
That's why I never do
But she's
that.
Already seen this. Yeah. I guess if you've looked into the eyes of the protomolecule man, nothing seems terrifying anymore.
Yeah. Well, her belief system gets chucked out the window because nobody will back her up on this, right? So even though she's seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she'll be a Christian's bodyguard, and that relationship is delightful.
It is.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, it just reminds me a little bit of like, she reminds me a little bit of Bran of Tarth.
Oh, yeah, kind of, yeah.
Who's another great character. They're very different in so many ways, but just in the bodyguard capacity and seeing... I guess just seeing like two female characters come together and protect one another is really cool. And it happens in the same way in Game of Thrones, I think. So I'm going to think about that moving forward.
It's a good thought. And just on an aesthetic appreciation thing, when she lets her hair down to make the run for the ocean, I think that just... It's aesthetically appealing to me, but it also, it's a physical indicator of the change that she's going through. In a sense, seeking out the freedom, of the ocean,
Yeah, I think we were watching it also. Katie was like, that actually looks like the actress just took her hair down. It looks like.
Said that because the way it curled, because I always do that like top knot thing as well. And I was like, oh, so realistic.
One thing I wanted to go back to and see is, I think she almost is always referred to as Gunny up to this point. I think this is where she starts being referred to as Bobby more, which is
right,
obviously
yeah.
because she's not part of this military structure. But I do think that's a really interesting shift in her character.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly natural, you know. Gunny is a common shorthand for gunnery sergeant in the military. So it's what she would be called routinely on the job. And she's less and less on the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just as a complete side note, can I say I want a window that I can have voice activated, turns into a mirror, and then just frosts up whenever I tell it to? That'd be pretty awesome.
That's pretty great.
Same.
The half-baked actor that we ran into in the half-baked medical facility / biology area, that's Katoa's father. So at least we get to...
Yeah.
That's another little pang of guilt there, as we know that Katoa is actually going to be turned into yet another proto-molecule zombie. That's...
I know, knowing the fates of these respective kids makes that scene layers that it didn't have the first time, and maybe also gives you a taste, if you haven't read the books, of what that might be like if you're watching this as a book reader and for the first time and knowing where that's going.
Yeah. And Ganymede is going to be bad.
Oof. Oh, yeah.
What I don't remember is, because Ganymede is the breadbasket of the belt, I don't remember how they handle that going forward. That's a very, very important food supply.
I think they brush over it, frankly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Shame on you, Expanse. We don't like you as a series anymore.
Yep, you failed completely.
Yeah. Coming out of this conversation, you know, I still feel like these are slightly weaker episodes than the bulk, but they've got important connecting tissue in them to the rest of the storyline. So I wouldn't throw them over the bridge or anything.
Yeah, and there's enough individual moments that really I remembered and were still wonderful on rewatch.
Yeah, well, the next couple...
Yeah, and, like, they were great for on a plane, really. They did kill a long trip home. So.
Oh, and on that note, we know, of course, that the next two episodes, Here There Be Dragons and The Monster and the Rocket, will be similarly just uneventful, and nothing serious will happen. It's just all connective tissue, and, you know...
Yep.
Aaron Wright's not going to turn on them or anything else like that, so... So we really do thank you for joining us on A Legitimate Salvage, and we'll be back next week for the similarly uneventful episodes, so episodes 11 and 12 of Season 2. We're almost to the end of the second season. We've been moving like a rocket. Like we've been moving like we've got an Epstein drive strapped to our backs.
Unexplained Epstein drive.
Maybe that's what this podcast should have been called, Unexplained Epstein Drive. But until we come back, Godspeed, Cowboys.